At Farm to Table, we know how confusing healthcare is. We're here to simplify the healing process. We believe that healthcare should be simple. It should help people feel better. That's why we started the Table Talk podcast, to gather around the table with you, no matter where you are. We want to come and learn together and discuss a new healthcare approach that addresses the root cause of your symptoms. The journey for each person is unique, but together we can thrive. All right. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. Today, I have with me two of our pharmacists that are part of our Farm to Table team, who have you've met before. So we have Dr. Megan Morrison, who is in San Antonio, Texas. And then we also have Dr. Jessica Orlowski, who is in Mountaintop, Pennsylvania. So thank you both for joining me today. And today's topic is so important. We talk about the gut all the time. So if you haven't heard us talk about the microbiome yet, you probably haven't listened to too many of our podcasts, but we are going to talk today about drug-induced microbiome disruption. So this is a little bit different than we talked before about drug-induced nutrient depletion. So not just are drugs affecting, it's not just that they're affecting the actual levels of certain nutrients as they're being metabolized and using up those nutrients or blocking certain nutrients from being produced, but they're actually disrupting the microbiome. And so we've talked before about the microbiome. And the reason why we're talking about this is that over 60% of the population in the US takes at least one prescription medication, and a fourth of all those drugs can negatively affect the microbiome. So the microbiome is virtually linked to every aspect of our health. You guys have heard us before say Hippocrates said that all disease begins in the gut thousands of years ago. And really, that's becoming to be a true statement as we learn more and more about the gut. So he knew a lot of things in his wisdom at that point. And so when we talk about this, many of the prescription and non-prescription drugs we take can affect the gut and cause dysbiosis. So just to define that word to start out with today, dysbiosis is when we have an imbalance of the bacteria that should be there with potential pathogens or even an imbalance in the bacteria themselves. So maybe we have too much of one type of phylum that could cause more increased risk of bloating. Sometimes there's not actually a pathogen present. It's those good bacteria that become overgrown, and maybe we have too much yeast not enough of the good bacteria that could be contributing to someone's symptoms. Or maybe they're even asymptomatic. Some people with autoimmune disease present to us with we do a stool test and they have no gut symptoms at all, but they have hardly any commensal bacteria, or maybe they are missing certain phylums and maybe their digestion is suboptimal despite the fact that they're not having symptoms. So this could be affecting you or a loved one, despite the fact that you may not have bloating, diarrhea, constipation, and some of those symptoms. So what it can affect, imbalances in the microbiome can cause disruptions in digestion. So certain bacteria are responsible for breaking down our carbohydrates. Certain bacteria help produce certain vitamins from the food we eat or metabolize those vitamins to make them in the form that we need to use them in. Certain bacteria help recycle estrogen. So lots of different pieces there. So nutrient absorption. There's also the whole conversation about the gut-brain axis. So we have immunity, we have mood, we have cognitive function, we have brain inflammation. So if we have a permeable gut because there's been damage, we also know that that can increase our risk for hyperpermeability in the blood-brain membrane and can cause there to be increased inflammation there. So I mentioned the estrogen thing. So the hormonal balance piece is important with the microbiome as well. And then blood sugar balance. So that's one of my passions, is that treating diabetes from a root cause perspective should include a look at someone's gut, discussion of prebiotic fibers, looking at someone's stress levels and all of those things involved. So the gut has a big role in producing even hormone signaling from certain byproducts of bacteria to tell you you're full and to tell the pancreas, you know, what job it needs to do, or stimulate other hormones to do that. So super important connection there. And then sleep is really important. So the microbiome can actually cause disruptions in your sleep cycle and the hormones involved in sleeping, and detox vacation, which we're going to talk about on a future podcast following this one, and then appetite, weight gain, and other potential drug effects. So lots of different things that the microbiome has a role in. And so if we are using medications that disrupt that microbiome, we just want to watch out for those signs and symptoms of those things. And also, how do we prevent those in the future? How do we keep a healthy gut if we do have to take a medication? Or is there something else we could take to treat our symptom or reverse the symptom by using functional medicine and not need to take that medication? So Megan, why don't you kick us off with, like, what are the drugs that really affect the microbiome here?
Sure. So Melody mentioned at the beginning that a quarter of all drugs can disrupt the microbiome, and with, I don't know, the thousands of drugs on the market, I mean, that's a lot of drugs, and so many of us are on a medication for one reason or another. So let's list some of the common ones. Antibiotics, I think that's probably everyone knows that, right? Like, I think we've all taken at least one antibiotic in our lifetime, and GI side effects, you know, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, like those are very common with antibiotics, and that's probably due to that microbiome disruption. Antibiotics are great because they're killing off those bad bugs, but they also kill off our good bugs, which isn't so great. Sure. That's probably the most common.
Yeah, and some evidence talks about like it can take like a year for the microbiome to recover potentially.
Oh yeah, and just like one course of antibiotics, mm-hmm. right? Like this isn't someone, you know, necessarily who's on chronic antibiotics. Mm-hmm. Like one course can really affect our microbiome. So that's a very big deal. Another one is NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Those are over-the-counter drugs that so many of us take for different reasons, and those can definitely affect our gut. Steroids, another big one is hormonal birth control. I mean, that's huge. So many women are on those, and sadly, the side effects, you know, adverse effects of those aren't really talked about much. So just good to know. PPIs is another one, proton pump inhibitors. People take those for acid reflux. Those are now sold over the counter as well. And we're going to talk a little bit more in depth about a few of these, including PPIs. But man, those were not designed to be taken for long periods of time.
Yeah, and I don't think when they were designed, like anyone was thinking about these things either. You know, like, oh, I know we're going to go into further detail about that, but it was, we're going to help the body to not have as much acid so we can heal, help calm down some of the damage and in the inflammation, and people feel better with heartburn. But it wasn't really like, okay, well, what is this actually doing in the following sequela of those changes in the body?
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's just with any drug, right? There's going to be side effects, and we take it for one problem, but then maybe a new problem occurs and then we need a new drug. So yeah, that's where the beauty of functional medicine comes in, right? Trying to find the root causes. But a few more drugs that affect the microbiome, statins, that's a huge group. Some of the antipsychotics and antidepressants like the SSRIs, opioids, beta blockers and ACE inhibitors. So and that's just a short list, but some of the more common drugs. So we just want to educate on this, and obviously never stop taking your medication without first talking to your doctor. But knowing this and trying to do things to help the gut prevent some of those long-term issues is what we're trying to do today.
Yeah, awesome. And there's even some drugs that have a positive impact on the microbiome. I know you have metformin on the list, but there's actually some data that metformin can actually increase Acromantia species, which is a positive thing for the gut. So sometimes, you know, how they're shifting or how they're working, maybe even how the mechanism of metformin is helping the body is partially due to its effect on the gut. So I think that's really interesting too, that part of this change in the gut microbiome could actually be part of the therapeutic benefit of certain classes of medications.
Yeah. And I wanted to point out real quick, like we're talking about, I guess, kind of the way drugs affect the microbiome, but in reverse, the microbiome can also affect drugs, mm-hmm. right? The efficacy, the toxicity, different things like that. So I don't think we're going to get too deep into that, but it's really cool. There's like a bi-directional thing going on here. And it just, I think, all goes back to how brilliant our microbiome is and how we need to really just like tend and take care of it.
Yes. Yes. Awesome. And so what about other drugs that are maybe more recreational?
Yeah. So some of these, maybe we don't think about as drugs, but they are, alcohol being one of them. And I think that's a huge one that a lot of people partake in because of different reasons, right? Stress or just that's kind of what a lot of people do. They go out with friends and have a drink or two, but that can definitely affect the microbiome. And then some more recreational drugs, methamphetamines, marijuana, and nicotine. I feel like not as many people are smoking these days, but definitely still out there, and that can and affect the microbiome. And then caffeine, that is a drug. Coffee, tea, different things like that. And there's actually some evidence that there are some positive changes with caffeine. So kind of like what Melody said, I think we focus on the negative, but there can be some positive changes. So that's really neat to point out.
Yeah. So like the alcohol piece, the red wine can have a positive effect on microbiome diversity in moderate amounts, but overconsumption of alcohol and other types of alcohol generally upset the microbiome diversity or decrease diversity in the microbiome.
And let's point out, Melody, you said moderate amount.
Moderate, yes, moderate amounts of red wine. That does not mean your whole bottle of red wine.
Every night, right? Get to sleep. Yeah.
So, and I think that comes again. So red wine has polyphenols. Polyphenols are, you know, antioxidants. Antioxidants are having this positive change on the microbiome. But at the same time, there are also things about alcohol, including wine, that may increase certain people's risk of breast cancer or other things if they consume it even on a regular basis in moderate amounts. So it's all an individual decision, you know, what you partake in and how much you take in of those things. But yeah, caffeine, that's interesting that certain, like tea, especially again, polyphenols and tea, maybe what's increasing the bifidobacterium species. It'd be interesting to know if that's just related to caffeine, the chemical alone, or if it's related to in the coffee with the polyphenols or in the tea that has, and most likely I would assume that it is related to the actual whole plant version of whatever has the caffeine in it. It's having those positive benefits on the microbiome. So
just like food, right? Like we talk a lot about supplements and how great they are, but food has all of these compounds that work together. So.
Yeah, synergistically. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you needed another reason to quit smoking, your microbiome can be on that list. Yeah. So quitting smoking, smoking cessation increases your microbiome diversity. So, I mean, I think there's just so many reasons for people. It's hard if you've struggled with that for years, but someone on our team can help you. Your doctor can help you. We'd really love to see our audience get off nicotine if you can. Just so many good things to come after that. All right. So let's go into details about a few of the big drug classes. So Jessica, why don't you talk to us about antibiotics and how do they mess up our gut and how does just a few doses or a 1 5-day course impact us for so long?
Yes. So I work in a pharmacy. I own a pharmacy and these drugs that we just mentioned earlier, including antibiotics. So yes, they're like Melody said, a quarter of prescription medications, but they're also our top movers. Like, so, you know, I'm filling antibiotics every day. I'm filling statins every day. I'm filling PPIs every day and even making these recommendations over the counter. So the majority of medications that are leaving the door at the pharmacy are unfortunately microbiome disrupting drugs. So antibiotics, fortunately, I think a lot of people realize that it can affect our microbiome. So most patients come in, they ask for a probiotic, they know what it can cause gut side effects like diarrhea, stomach pain, and even doctors too now are very commonly recommending probiotics for patients. If you're looking for a probiotic with an antibiotic, make sure it has a lot of species in it, not just one. But what happens with antibiotics is they are going to kill the infection that you're trying to get at, but they're also going to kill the bacteria, the good bugs in our stomach. And this can last. So for example, like a Z-Pak or azithromycin, Augmentin, they're the big players and they can actually disrupt your microbiome and take 6 months to a year to get back to normal. And that's if you only have one course of them. But some patients, unfortunately, they might get multiple Z-Paks a year or multiple antibiotics a year. And so that never gives their gut time to catch up, never gives their gut time to kind of get back to normal with the good balance of the good and the bad bugs.
And this can last, even just a few doses can affect the microbiome for years, especially when you think about, I mean, I just think about the poor babes that have ear infections all the time and get prescribed multiple rounds of antibiotics during that initial first or second year of life. And this can have an impact in their microbiome for the rest of their life. I'm not saying don't ever take an antibiotic because they are life-saving medications for many situations, but 1 in 3 prescriptions for antibiotics are often deemed unnecessary. So many times patients get antibiotics for viral infections or other conditions that are not treatable with antibiotics. And so that's really where we have done in the last 10 years or so, as antibiotic resistance has started to rear its ugly head, where these bacteria get smart and they come up with ways to not be killed by the antibiotics that they once were killed by, that allows more and more, the resistance more and more has caused the healthcare system to say, hey, we need to be tighter controlled on how we use these antibiotics. So there's something called antimicrobial stewardship that pharmacists are involved with in hospitals and even outpatient basis, and helping limit the use of antibiotics to make sure that we are using more narrow spectrum agents at the beginning. And if we know what we're treating, we use those agents so that we don't cause as much disruption to the microbiome. But one of the ways that this is happening is that antibiotics can cause lipopolysaccharide to be released into the gut, which is related to some of the byproducts of gram-negative bacteria. And it causes reduction in gut microbiome diversity, but also causes inflammation and can increase risk of intestinal permeability. And so these antibiotics affect the commensal bacteria, so that good bacteria that's supposed to be in our gut, which can reduce the butyrate producing species. So butyrate is a byproduct of the good bacteria called a short chain fatty acid. And butyrate actually helps with metabolic processes in the body, helps to make you feel full. It also decreases oxidative stress and inflammation, can affect or improve allergy symptoms and stabilize mast cells. So butyrate is huge. We can actually do stool tests where we can look at your levels of butyrate, and we can look at percentage of short chain fatty acids that someone has going on. So for me, that's a big part of me taking care of patients and helping them improve their gut health, is really knowing where they're starting with those short chain fatty acids and commensals. Part of the research now is not just which probiotic do we take while we're taking an antibiotic to help reduce this. And I think we've got a couple that have good data in antibiotic associated diarrhea. We're still trying to figure out like which strain is exactly the best for preventing that year long disruption in the microbiome. Certainly Saccharomyces boulardii, which is actually a beneficial yeast strain, has been studied a lot in antibiotic associated diarrhea. But it's an interesting conversation because there actually have been a few studies that they did a stool transfer, sort of like a fecal microbiome transfer. And then they also had a group that took antibiotics that took probiotics. And then they had a group that just was supposed to recover spontaneously. And the group that took the probiotics actually took longer for them to recover than to the group that was recovering spontaneously. So we can link that study for you. I think there's been other studies that maybe have disproven that, or different strains. And so that's the thing about microbiome. There's specific strains that do specific actions. And so we really just have to follow the research on this topic to determine really what we should be using. But right now, my recommendation is Saccharomyces boulardii. So feel free if you guys want to add in any tidbits, or, and then Jess, if you want to talk about proton pump inhibitors, and we can move on to that.
I can take PPIs.
Okay.
And you know, Jess owns a pharmacy, so she definitely has some good tidbits she can add in. But I mentioned PPIs earlier. That stands for proton pump inhibitors. And these medications are like so highly used. They are now, most of them are over the counter. So, you know, we get prescribed these and doctors really aren't helping us come off of them, or telling us they should only be used for a short amount of time, maybe 8 to 12 weeks. And I think a lot of times in the hospital, you might get prescribed them and then you get discharged and then you're on them for years just because no one's ever told you to stop them, right?
I had a patient that I was reviewing his chart and asked him like why he was taking this proton pump inhibitor. And he couldn't tell me a reason. He said he didn't have heartburn. He didn't have any stomach issues. So I was like, okay. And then, so I looked back in his record and I could only find that the reason he was taking it was he got prescribed it when he was in the hospital, probably for stress ulcer prophylaxis. And he had been taking it for like 12 years since then.
Yeah.
And no one has said, hey, like, stop this. Like, how often is this happening? It's like, this is like crazy.
It happens on a weekly basis at our pharmacy. The discharge sheets with the PPI, and now I'm even seeing a PPI with Pepcid, like famotidine, weren't on. There's probably no reason they need to be on it. It was just stress ulcer prophylaxis. And I always try to bring it up in conversation, like, why did you have stomach issues? And they're like, no. But then, tell them to bring it up at their follow-up with their primary doctor. But they stay on for a long time.
Yeah. Or they go to the ER and then get prescribed a PPI for nausea. And I'm like, this is not the indication for this PPI. And I don't think it works for nausea. But I think people are just like, I need to get this person to the next room. And they think it's benign. And that's a problem. The healthcare system thinks it's benign in general, and it's not.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing with the PPIs is they can be very hard to come off of. So, you know, people might try to stop them themselves and then they get this rebound acid reflux or these stomach issues, and then it's so much easier to just stay on them. So
yeah,
that's definitely a problem. And we can talk a lot more about PPIs because they cause a lot of issues.
Yeah. And there may be some reason for people to stay on them. So backing up a little bit to what a PPI does and is, it actually blocks the acid production in the stomach. And so it actually makes your stomach more basic, which helps you not to feel like you've got this fiery, burning esophagus. But at the same time, you need acid in your stomach to denature proteins, to stimulate the digestive process, to keep the bacteria in the small intestine at a good level. Otherwise, we risk this small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And so we can start to see some of these changes. And so if we're not getting good protein digestion, we've got this extra bacteria, we start to get these bloating symptoms and other side effects of the medication related to all these changes in the microbiome. But there are indications like if people have Barrett's esophagus, which is damage to the esophagus that is shown to be able to, can progress to esophageal cancer. Certainly that makes sense for someone to stay on this until we can figure out the root cause of things, or maybe they'll never figure out the root cause depending on how extensive the disease is. But for most people that are just using these for heartburn symptoms, we really need to start working on the root cause. I find a lot of times the root cause can be related to, we can talk further about this on a longer podcast, but it can be related to certain bacteria in the gut. It can be related to yeast. It can be related to H. pylori is a common bacteria that can cause gastritis and inflammation of the stomach. And then sometimes it can be physical things. So there can be physical things out of balance in the body that can be contributing to heartburn. Sometimes those are hiatal hernias. Sometimes there's certain like spinal points that if those are out of balance, that can actually contribute to heartburn. So I've had times where my back is out of whack and all of a sudden I start getting heartburn and I go and get an adjustment and I'm better and it goes away. And it's like, amazing. Why does our healthcare system not recognize like how the physical element of the body is so important in our health and how everything is balanced too. So we could probably have a whole podcast, and we probably should have a whole podcast on deprescribing PPIs at another time, but certainly they impact the microbiome diversity and imbalance because of changing the pH of our stomach, which is the whole start of the digestive process and assimilating our nutrients and making sure we have everything our body needs to function. So, all right, let's talk about NSAIDs. Who wants to talk about NSAIDs?
I can tackle NSAIDs. NSAIDs stands for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And these are highly used. They are mostly over-the-counter, things like ibuprofen, Motrin, Aleve, naproxen. I mean, think of times when you've had a headache or some pain somewhere and you're just popping these guys. I've definitely been guilty of that. So no judgment, but they can definitely throw off your microbiome. It looks like the prevalence of at least once weekly NSAID use in individuals over 65 has been reported to be as high as 70%. So again, you know, they're just used so often. And again, you know, especially in the elderly population, maybe there's more aches and pains and they're using these and not thinking about the side effects. So just another one to be aware of.
And they do this really through the overgrowth of gram-negative bacteria and those anaerobic bacterial species, which really comes back to the whole LPS conversation, the endotoxin release, certain microbial metabolites that then lower mucosal defense, increase susceptibility of the cells to intestinal damage. And so I think about ulcers. We know NSAIDs can cause ulcers, but I don't think in school we were taught that this was actually related to the microbiome impact of like affecting the host immunity and the metabolites and LPS and all of this stuff. So it's super interesting that, you know, the things we learned happen from a drug are actually sometimes related to the changes in the microbiome.
Yeah. And that's a domino effect cascade I see in the pharmacy a lot, is somebody that presents with heartburn symptoms, but they're also taking a daily NSAID, whether it's prescription or over the counter. And so then adding on a over the counter PPI or something like that, it's just, you know, like I said, like a domino effect.
Isn't there like a dual naproxen omeprazole drug out there?
I think there's a prescription one, but I haven't seen it in a long time.
Yeah, but the whole idea like, oh, let's keep your body safe from the NSAID by giving you the PPI. And it's like, oh, wait, we're just causing more and more problems. I can't believe that older adults take 7 doses per week, like as high as 70% of the patients surveyed in that study. That's crazy. But I mean, I guess with aging comes pain, but pain management is just one of those things. We just don't have good good treatment options that don't have an impact on the rest of the body that actually work. Anyways, that could be a whole nother conversation too. All right, well, let's move on to statins. So what is what's going on with statins in the microbiome?
Statins are prescribed almost like water. It used to be that they would do it for cardiovascular benefits, especially in diabetic patients. But now, you know, if somebody's cholesterol is high, some patients aren't even given a chance to lower it, and they're just started right on a statin. So they are super prevalent, and they're the number two most prescribed drug in the United States. I have patients from all ages, say in their 20s, all the way to senior citizens on statins. And they have a direct effect on the microbiome that basically decreases the diversity. So that's what we want, is we want a lot of a lot of good bacteria, bad bacteria, a good balance. So they can change our digestion. And when we counsel patients on statins, we can say this can cause diarrhea or constipation. So it can slow or speed up our digestion, which then also affects the microbiome. And they can change inflammatory markers in the gut too. So a gut is a good place with the immune system to regulate inflammation. But if it's increasing inflammation in the gut, that's also not a benefit for patients.
Yeah, for sure. The other really interesting thing about statins is there's actually data that sort of like what Megan was talking about, this bidirectional relationship. So there's data that certain patients with more bacteroides in their microbiome of their phylums, those patients have a higher risk for statin-induced metabolic disruption. And then the patients that have the Firmicutes and they're more dominant for Firmicutes have a lower risk of statin-induced metabolic disruption. So when we think about the statins causing, there's a lot of links now to statins increasing blood sugar. And some studies were like, well, they do. But it's right here. It's like, if depending on your metabolic piece in your gut and what your gut microbiome looks like is going to depend on if this affects you or not. And so maybe someone needs a statin because they've had multiple heart attacks and they have family history of familial hypercholesteremia and their cholesterol is really high, which certainly there's inflammation and other things we have to consider there. But there are some people, Lp(a) patients that have this really genetic risk that maybe it makes sense for, but there's ways that we can support the gut to hopefully help them mitigate some of these side effects and making sure they are more of that Firmicutes dominant individual. So super interesting. And always, I always think like, oh man, we're just on such at the tip of the iceberg of this metabolic thing. I feel like it's going to take probably hundreds more years till someone really like cracks the what do we do to prevent these things for everybody. So any other thoughts on statins?
Nope. I think just, Melody, you mentioned at the beginning when we were talking about drug-induced nutrient depletion as well. A lot of these drugs also cause nutrient depletion. Statins are a big one. So
Yeah. So if you're on a statin, please take some CoQ10 and some magnesium. For sure. Yeah. And that's something that unfortunately I just feel like in the healthcare system, like not everyone is telling them to do. And if they are telling them to do it, they might not even be taking the appropriate dose. So like with CoQ10, you have to take 100 milligrams to sort of level out the statin depletion and making sure that you're getting that every day. And CoQ10 is so important to the mitochondria, which are also important when we talk about blood sugar control and metabolic health. And so it's not just the microbiome disruption of the statins that are contributing to that. There's so many other pieces of that for sure. All right. Well, let's move on to oral contraceptives. So how do oral contraceptives and hormone replacement affect our gut?
So actually the estrogens in these oral contraceptives are reported to alter the diversity of the microbiome. Like Jess mentioned, we need a lot of good bugs and we need diverse good bugs. So these estrogens can alter that diversity and they can alter intestinal permeability, or you might know that as leaky gut. So just important to be aware of. And there's actually studies show that there's a high incidence of people with irritable bowel disease, particularly Crohn's, when taking oral contraceptives. So again, me in pharmacy school, just learning about hormonal birth control, and there's definitely side effects and we learned about those, but I feel like it wasn't talked about in depth. It was kind of like, oh yeah, if a girl wants to be on an oral contraceptive starting at 14, 15 and on it for decades, like go ahead. And again, just like with all other drugs, I mean, there's definitely risk involved. So it's important, especially us as pharmacists, talking to our patients when they come in about these, you know, lesser, maybe lesser known adverse effects.
I once saw a post, I think it was a female health, like she focused on female health with functional medicine. And she posted something that said, like, you will never meet your health goals while on an oral contraceptive. And at first I was like, wow, that's harsh. But then as I thought about it, all the side effects that kind of aren't, not that they're not disclosed to patients, but they're kind of like brushed over or like forgotten, you know, like risk of, say, disrupting like mood instabilities and like the chances of ending up on an SSRI or having anxiety or depression from an oral contraceptive, irritable bowel disease. And again, I think it all kind of goes back to disrupting the microbiome. So our gut makes almost 80% of our serotonin. And when you're taking this every day for, like Megan said, possibly decades, what are the repercussions of that?
Yeah, that's a good point. Like going back to the microbiome and the mood, right? I think we have a post, we've talked about in a podcast too, like the mood gut connection. So yeah, just crazy.
Yeah. And the other
the good old microbiome.
Yeah, for sure. The other thing too, is we have such short-term information about the effects of these things. Like we don't have studies for that girl that you're talking about that is 14 starting an oral contraceptive and taking it until she's 44, right? Like right. Maybe taking off a couple years to have a baby and getting back on. We don't know, like, what is the difference between that person and someone that never took birth control? And what about the person that only took it for 10 years versus half her life? And so I think that is something that we need to do a better job about studying in the research. So researchers out there, that's a question that we have. Is there a certain time point where maybe it makes sense? So maybe people that really need to prevent kids during college or younger adults, but is there this, you know, once we're getting to a certain point where does it really make sense where we need to? And there's other options for birth control, certainly vaginal insertion, whether that IUD or NuvaRing might be a little bit less effect on the gut as far as how it impacts the microbiome. And then certainly natural family planning options, which the Oura Ring, I don't know if you guys have seen this, but the Oura Ring now has a connection with another app. I think it's called Nature or Natura. I'd have to look it up and we'll link it in the show notes, but it might look it up now, but it can track your temperatures every morning. And so it like tells you if you're fertile or you're not fertile, like in this app every morning. It's like approved by the FDA as a form of birth control. So that's pretty amazing. It's called Natural Cycles, powered by Oura. So we will link that. And it's the first FDA cleared birth control that it's non-hormonal at all. So that's pretty cool that we have some of these cool technologies that we can work with now instead. So those are the main ones that we really wanted to talk about today. And we always want to reemphasize, you can't just stop taking prescription medications. Some medications need titrated to help you not have crazy rebound symptoms, especially the PPIs. So always talk with your provider before you stop it. And then if you are taking it over the counter, again, conversation with your pharmacist, your physician, whoever you can have access to. And then really there may be some natural options that you can use instead. So you could always talk to a natural health provider, functional medicine provider, someone on our team. We have a brief supplement consult. And then the healing the gut piece, if you're having gut symptoms or you suspect that you may have some lack of diversity or impact in your microbiome from years of taking one of these agents, certainly a stool test that looks at those short chain fatty acids, looks at your microbiome diversity could be really important. And then just taking the steps like nutrition wise, like start eating those fiberful, colorful foods and start putting those into your diet. But if those make you feel bad, so you're eating bacteria, fermented foods, you're eating the fiber foods, lots of fruits and vegetables, and you're feeling worse as far as bloating, diarrhea, constipation, then that's really when you need to work with a provider to figure out what's going on, because there may be an overgrowth and a potential pathogen or something that needs corrected before we can really start feeding that gut again. And then other things to think about that have impact on the gut, there aren't necessarily drugs, but are like artificial sweeteners. And I'm not going to call it the company, but there is a company my husband bought And I was like, oh, this looks good. I'm going to drink this too. And it was a post-workout supplement that's marketed to CrossFit athletes. And most of the time, a lot of the products that are marketed to CrossFit athletes are very clean. Most of the product is very clean. I get to the last ingredient and it's sucralose. And I was like, what? Like, he's been drinking this with sucralose for the last like several months, which is Splenda, and has lots of data about microbiome disruption and effects on insulin resistance and, you know, weight gain, which I always say, like, I don't see a lot of people drinking Diet Pop actually losing weight. So part of it is all of this effect on the microbiome. So really watch your products, watch your labels, make sure that you're not consuming these extra things that you think are healthy. There's even some conversation about stevia and the microbiome, but I don't think we have quite as much information as we do with some of these artificial sweeteners. So any other thoughts on that, ladies, to close us out?
Just real quick mention, you know, like Melody said, some people need to be on these medications, and we definitely understand that. We're not saying to stop them, but think of other things we can do to help out the gut if we are taking these drugs that affect the gut. So, you know, limiting those poor food choices, trying to eat whole foods, and even some of those lifestyle things to just kind of calm the nervous system, get out of the sympathetic fight or flight. Mm-hmm. All those things can help the gut to kind of minimize the impact of the drug.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us today. And as always, you can find us at farmtotable.life, PharmToTable.life. And we look forward to chatting with you again soon. Thanks for listening. We're excited you are on your journey with us. Find us online at farmtotable.life, farm with a P, and on Instagram at farmtotableteam.